Okay, I want to start with something in the aftermath of Purim. It's still close enough to Purim to speak about Purim. And a little bit about the something I found interesting this year that I didn't ever speak about before. It says in the Megillah the following. Al-Kain ha-Yehudim ha-Prozim ha-Yoshvim be-Orei ha-Prozos. Therefore, the Jews who live in the unwalled cities, Osim es Yom Arbos or Lechodesh Adar, they make the 14th day of Adar Simcha u'Mishte. First it mentions Simcha, and then partying, Simcha, and then Mishte, and a Yom Tov, right? The Yom Tov usually means you don't do work. U'Mishloach Manos Ish L'Re'eil, and sending food gifts one to the other. What's missing from this list?
Megillah.
What?
Megillah.
Megillah, okay. But what's more? The mitzvah, Matanos Levyonim. Says sending gifts one to the other, but doesn't mention anything about Matanos Levyonim. And it also mentions first they made Simcha and then Mishta. And also it mentions Yontif. Also it doesn't say anything about the people on the 15th. Just the people on the 14th in the unwalled cities. Doesn't mention anything about people in the walled cities on the 15th. Then it says that that Mordechai sent letters to all of the communities, and he instituted Purim in the following way. It says, La'asos osam, yimei mishte v'simcha, to make them days of mishte and simcha. Here the order is reversed. They made it Simcha and Mishta, and he instituted to make Mishta the Simcha. U'mishloach manos ish l'reyehu, u'matanos levyonim. So here, Yontif is missing. No Yontif. Mishloach manos, and he adds matanos levyonim, and changes the order Simcha and Mishta to Mishta and Simcha. There must be a reason why. And he, mentions also the right before that it says Kayomim Asher Nochu Lakayim Aleim Lios Osim Es Yom Arbos or Lechodesh Ador the Es Yom Chamishos or Bo Bechol Shana V'Shana, 14th and the 15th. Before it only mentioned the 14th and all those other differences. So I saw that many of the commentaries at least bring up the question why the change of the order. Here it says Simcha and Mishta, and here it says Mishta and Simcha. And they say a very simple answer, which I'm going to show you can't be. They say a very simple answer. The first pasuk was talking about what they did, that generation. The people themselves, whose lives were saved, made a Simcha and a Mishta. They didn't need a party to be happy. They were happy because their lives were saved. So they were happy, and then they expressed their happiness through a party. But Mordechai was instituting this for future generations. Future generations had nothing to be happy about. Their lives weren't saved. In order to get happy, they had to make a Mishta, and then they had Simcha. So the generation that experienced these occurrences had the Simcha and then the Mishta. And future generations would have to have the Mishta that led them to the Simcha. Very nice pshat, but it can't be. Because there's two sentences before this that speak about the people of that generation celebrating the Yontif, and it says the following. B'yom Shloshasar L'Chodesh Adar says that the Jews in the unwalled cities fought their enemies on the 13th, the Noach B'Arbasar Bo, and they rested on the 14th, V'aso Oso Yom Mishte V'Simcha, and they made it a day of Mishte and Simcha. According to these opinions, it should have said they made it a day of Simcha and Mishta. We're talking about the people who actually lived through these things. We're talking about the people who went through this war, whose lives were saved. And it says there, Mishta v'Simcha. And the same thing it says in the next sentence. V'ha-Yehudim asher b'Shushan, nikalu b'Shloshasar bo, v'Arbasar bo, the Jews in Shushan gathered on the 13th and the 14th and killed their enemies. The Noach b'chamishosar bo, and they rested on the 15th. V'aso also yom mishta v'simcha. They also made it a mishta v'simcha. So according to this idea that the people who actually lived through it and experienced it, simcha comes first, doesn't hold water. Here it says openly that the Mishnah came before the Simcha. And we're talking about the people who actually lived through it. So that can't be the answer. So let me tell you what I think. I think it's the following. Originally, the Jews, on the 14th, their lives were in danger because Haman's edict had not been rescinded, because you can't rescind a royal edict, as it says in the Megillah. The most they could do is they were given the right to defend themselves. So they didn't know what was going to come out. So they fought their enemies on the 13th. On the 14th, they had a mishteh v'simcha. Why? We always say on Chanukah, why on Chanukah isn't there a mitzvah to have a party? There's a mitzvah to sing praises to the Ribbono Shel Olam. We light candles. But there's no mitzvah to have a suda. You don't have to have meals like we have a Purim suda. Because Chanukah, the salvation was spiritual. Our lives weren't in danger. If we would have given up the Torah, the Greeks had no problem with us. It's only because we wanted to keep the Torah that we had a problem. So therefore, the danger was a spiritual danger. So we celebrated spiritually, with lighting candles, with Hodah, with Hallel, and so on. But Purim, we were in physical danger. So we celebrated physically. And we have a physical party, eating and drinking, to celebrate our lives. Eating and drinking is a physical thing. So therefore, they saw this as a salvation, a physical salvation. So the people on the 14th, who lives were saved when they fought their enemies on the 13th, made a party to celebrate this, and that was the way that they had came to Simcha. And the people on the 15th, the same day, same thing. They had 2 days to fight their enemies, and on the 15th, they came out okay, physically, so they made a mishnah, the Simcha. No problem. What happened was the following. The people of the 14th saw that the people of the 15th had 2 days to kill Amalekim, even though their lives weren't in danger. Meaning, after the first day, right, the enemies that threatened the people in Shushan were pretty much decimated. It's only Esther who asked that they be given another day to kill more Amalekim, more Goy. So had Esther not asked for it, it wouldn't have been necessary. So all of a sudden, there's another aspect to this. And that is, it's not just our lives were in danger and we defended ourselves and we were saved. But somehow there's something over here that has nothing to do with our lives being in danger. We're going out, the people in Shushan, and killing Amalekim, right? Who are not endangering us. Now that already has implications. Because it says that before the Beis HaMikdash will be built, you have three mitzvahs, that two of them that precede the building of the Beis HaMikdash. The third is the building of the Beis HaMikdash. One is to appoint a king. The second is that king will then destroy the Amalekim together with the Jewish people, and then you build the Beis HaMikdash. That's what happened before the first Beis HaMikdash. They appointed a king, Shaul, who was supposed to destroy Amalek, and then they were supposed to build the Beis HaMikdash. It didn't happen until much later because it didn't work out the way it was supposed to. But in any case, that's the order. You have to appoint the king, you have to destroy Amalek, then you build the Beis HaMikdash. That's the way it's going to be in the future. We'll have a king, Melech HaMashiach will be the king. He will destroy our enemies, including Amalek, and then there'll be the building of the third Beis HaMikdash. When they saw that the people in Shushan had an extra day of killing Amalekim and had nothing to do with their lives being in danger, they said, you know what? Mashiach's coming. This is the prelude to Mashiach. You need a king. What else did they see? They saw that Mordechai Yotzam Lefnei HaMelech Bilvush Malchus. He came out wearing royal garments. They said, that's our king. Mordechai is going to be the king. We are now in the process of killing Amalekim. Right? Not because they endanger us. We're going out aggressively killing them. And eventually, the third Beis HaMikdash is going to be built. Not the second Beis HaMikdash. The second Beis HaMikdash was not a real Beis HaMikdash. It was missing some incidental things, like the Shechinah, like the Aron, the Luchos, the Urim, the Tumim. Right? It's like a shul without a Sefer Torah, without an Aron Kodesh. It was a nice meeting place. It was a place you could bring sacrifices. But it wasn't a real Beis HaMikdash. The real Beis HaMikdash that will replace the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed will be the third Beis HaMikdash. That's why we mourn pretty much for the first Beis HaMikdash, even though we had a second one, because the second one really never replaced the first one. So we have Asar B'Teves, which mourns only the first Beis HaMikdash, because we never recovered what we lost in the first Beis HaMikdash. They assumed, from the fact that the people in Shushan had an extra day to kill Amalekim, that this Yom Tov was no longer just saving our lives. This is the prelude to Mashiach. And therefore, as that, they said, it's not just a physical simcha, this is a spiritual simcha. So they made it Yom Simcha U'Mishta. The main thing is a spiritual, and we're going to express that spiritual simcha with a party. But it's not that the main thing is the party, because celebrating the saving of our lives, now it's something different. Now when they saw the next year, they saw what had happened in Shushan, this is what they assumed, and therefore they made a Yom Tov. This is going to be a day like any Yom Tov min HaTorah. A Yom Tov is a day that is beyond time, that hints to eternity. Meaning the following, Shabbos is Me'ein Olam Haba. Shabbos is an echo of the future world. And every Yom Tov is also called a Shabbos. There are really two Yomim Tovim, and Shavuos is the end of Sukkot, of Pesach, like Shmini Atzeres is the end of Sukkot. Except instead of coming on the 8th day, it comes on the 50th day. 7 times 7, instead of 7. In any case, so really there are two Yomim Tovim, Pesach and Shavuos. And they both fall on what day of the month? The 15th. Why? Because that's a full moon. That represents the height, the high point of the Jewish people. We're compared to the moon. When the moon is full, it means the Jewish people are complete. Pesach represents our past redemption, but it also is a hint to the future redemption. The redemption of Mashiach will be similar to the redemption of Pesach. So Pesach is an echo of the future, and Sukkot is the same thing. Sukkot, we say in benching, Harachamam Yokim Lanu Sukkas David Anofolos. Sukkot represents a time when God's protection of us with a Davidic dynasty and a Melech HaMoshiach will be complete, and that's what Sukkot represents. The past, but also represents the future. And that's on the 15th when the moon is full. So these people on the 14th said, hey, the people in Shushan got to kill Amalekim 2 days, one day when their lives weren't in danger, and they came out to celebrate on the 15th. That means that this is already the beginning of Yemos HaMashiach. This is the Geula. We're being redeemed. We're going to end up killing Amalekim. Mordechai is going to be our Melech, and we're going to build the third Beis HaMikdash, and this is it. So they made a Yom Tov, a real Yom Tov, right? Because this is it. This is the Yom Tov of the beginning of Geula. And they didn't make any Matanos Levyonim, because in the time of Mashiach, what's it called? Efes Lo Yebecha Evyon. There won't be any Evyonim. There won't be any poor people. So about Yom HaMashiach, everybody will be rich. Everybody will have what they need. So why make a mitzvah Matanos Levyonim? There's not going to be any of Yom. So that's why they made the Yom Tov Simcha and Mishta, because they saw it's not just a physical salvation. It's a spiritual beginning of redemption. They made it a Yom Tov, and they didn't make any Matanos Levyonim. But Mordechai realized that that's not the case. The Geula has not started. The Gemara says that Esther is called Ayeles HaShachar. Just like the Shachar, the dawn, is the end of night, so too Purim is the end of the period where miracles could be written in Tanakh. Meaning, it's not the beginning of Geula. It's the period that's a bridge between the end of Galus and the beginning of something else. It's not redemption, it's the end of Galus. Meaning that dawn, for certain things, b'di'evid, you can start mitzvahs of the day at dawn. But for other things, you can do mitzvahs that have to do at night at dawn. Dawn is like bein hashmashos, it's like twilight. It's day, but it's also night. It's a suffix. It's a doubtful kind of time. Dawn is the same thing. It's the beginning of day, but not really officially. And it's the end of night, but not really. It's a quasi-twilight kind of time. Okay. So Esther is not called the beginning of day. It's the end of night. It's the dawn period, but it's not the beginning of Geula. And Mordechai knew that. So why did the people in Shushan have 2 days to kill Amalekim, even if their lives weren't in danger? The answer is that there were two sins that made them vulnerable to harm. One sin all the Jewish people were involved in a generation earlier, but it didn't change in the next generation. The sin still remained, even though it didn't take place except a generation before. They bowed to the idol of Nebuchadnezzar. In other words, they considered Nebuchadnezzar more relevant and more important than God. They knew that God would not approve of them bowing to the idol of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar said everybody in his kingdom has to bow to this idol. Otherwise, what happens to them is they get thrown into the fiery furnace, which happened to Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. And everybody else bowed. Because they said, you know what, God abandoned us, we're in Gaulis, God is not relevant anymore to us, and if we don't get into the good graces of Nebuchadnezzar, we're going to have problems. So they all bowed to the Tselem of Nebuchadnezzar. Because of that, they were vulnerable to the decree of Haman. There was another sin, though. The sin was that Nehenu Misudas Achashverosh. They went and enjoyed the party of Achashverosh. But the Gemara says, if that's the case, that's only the Jews in Shushan. Jews world over didn't go to Achashverosh's party. They weren't invited. The only ones who went were the Jews of Shushan. So why did the other Jews suffer? The answer is, yeah. Everybody had at least one sin that they bowed to the Tselem of Nebuchadnezzar. So everybody needed one kapara. So they had one day to fight their enemies and kill the Amalekim, and that was a kapara. But Shushan had two sins. Their ancestors had bowed to the Tselem of Nebuchadnezzar, and they also enjoyed the party of Achashverosh. So the people in Shushan needed 2 days of kapara. So they had to kill Amalekim twice. One, to be mechaper for the Avera of bowing to the Tselem of Nebuchadnezzar, and the second, to be mechaper on the Avera of enjoying Achashverosh's party. But Mordechai knew that. But the rest of the Jews didn't know that. They understood that the Jews in Shushan have an extra day of killing Amalekim because Mashiach's coming. Mordechai knew that wasn't the case. And therefore Mordechai said, Purim is not going to be a Yontif. This is not the reason they have on the 15th. It's not because it's a Yontif. It's because they needed 2 days of Kapara. And it's not a Yontif. And there's still going to be poor people around. So he made Matonis Levyonim. And it's still basically a celebration of physical saving. And therefore it's Mishta and Simcha, not Simcha and Mishta. And this answers something that always bothered me. I think this is a tremendous idea, if I have to say so myself. What is the last chapter of the Megillah doing there? The last chapter of the Megillah, Lechora, has nothing to do with the Megillah. It could be left out completely. What does it say? Vayosem ha-melech ha-chashverosh mas al horetz. Right? It's the last chance that people have to make noise, right, against attacks. Right? I don't know, maybe other places they don't do that, but by me, right, more strongly than they do about Haman, they make about the mas. In any case, so what in the world? Who cares that Achashverosh made attacks on the people? What does that do with Purim? And then it says the next pasuk. I understand. It says Ki Mordechai the Chol Masik Tokfu Vuroso Poroshes Gedulas Mordechai Haloksuvim Al Sefer Divrei Hayom LeMalchim Modei Poros. You can find more about Mordechai in the history books of Media and Persia. Ki Mordechai a Yehudi Mishna LeMelech Achashverosh. Mordechai was a viceroy to King Achashverosh, the Rotsui Lerovechov, and he was liked by most of his brothers. The Gemara says not everybody liked him, right? Even Mordechai. Dover Sholom Liam, Dover Tov Liamov, the Doresh Tov Liamov, Dover Sholom Lechozar. So I understand, okay, a little bit about Mordechai. But what does that have to do with Achashverosh making a mas? The answer is that last parak puts the Megillah into perspective and the whole holiday of Purim. Without that, I would say, you know, they're right. The Gula is here. We got a Melech, and we're killing Amalekim. Excuse me. And this is the redemption. Comes the last parak and says, nothing doing. First of all, we are still in Shibud Malchios. Achashverosh is still the king, and he's still making taxes that we have to pay, and the hallmark of Gaulis is Shibud Malchios, that we are subjugated, subservient to the nations of the world. We're still subservient. As the Gemara says, Meikora Avdei, one of the reasons we don't say Hallel on Purim, like we do on Yom Tov, is because Meikora Avdei Achashverosh V'Hashvachted. We're still the slaves of Achashverosh. Nothing changed. By Pesach, we were originally slaves to Paro, now we're slaves to God. So we're free. But over here, we didn't get free. Our lives were saved. But to say Hallel, it's not like Hanukkah. It's not a redemption. It's in the beginning we were slaves to Achashverosh. In the end, how do you know in the end we're slaves to Achashverosh? By Yosem HaMelech Achashverosh Masal Oretz. And then, okay, so we have a king. Mordechai the king. Mordechai is not a king. Ki Mordechai Mishne LeMelech Achashverosh. Mordechai is not a king. He's just a viceroy to King Achashverosh. And if you want to know where Mordechai's greatness is, look in the history books of the Goyim. Right? Mordechai was a great guy for the Goyim, but he's not your king. So there's no king. There's no bitl of Shibud Malchios, and therefore there's no real Achdus. Everybody's together. There's still people who don't like Mordechai also. Right? I get tremendous nachas from that, at least, you know. Even Mordechai, right? So, you're a public figure, you know, you can't expect everybody to like you. So Mordechai was Rotzui L'Rovecha. Most people liked him. Okay. But that wasn't like the Achdus, the unity of Yemos HaMashiach. So the last parak puts Purim into perspective. Don't get carried away. Purim's a great yontem, but it's not the beginning of Geula. It's not the beginning of redemption. It has tremendous implications for today, which we will not go into, but you can figure it yourself, right? Sometimes people think that the Geula has come, you know, the redemption has come, this is, you know, Reishis Michas Geula Seinu. Maybe it's not, maybe it's just the end of Golus, but it's not really the beginning of Geula. For beginning Geula, you need a Melech, and you need, what's it called, Amalek, and you need a Binyan Beis HaMikdash, and you need Achdus of Klal Yisrael. Those things are missing, then maybe it's not a Geula. So it could be like in Bayesheni, a Pekida. Pekida means that the Rabban Hashem did us a favor, he brought us back to Eretz Yisrael, right? He gave us a poor replacement for the Beis HaMikdash. Even that was more than what we have today. But Lamaisa have to be thankful for it. That's for sure. But Geula, it's not Geula, weren't redeemed yet. So the last parak of the Megillah puts Purim into perspective. And that's the difference between how the people of the 14th saw the Yontif after experiencing what the people of the 15th did and misunderstanding it, and how Mordechai, who understood better what was going on, instituted the Yontif the way that he did and the way that we have it, based on the fact that it's not redemption, but it is a salvation. That's something interesting about the Megillah, I think. Okay, it answers a lot of questions, too. Okay, let's go to the Sedra. Sedra also has a lot of questions. It says that Nadav and Avihu, Torah seems to be very explicit about what happened over here. It says, Vayikhu shnei b'nei Aaron, Nadav and Avihu ish machtoso. They took a censer, a pan, right, where they put coals. Vayasimu bo'enesh, they put fire in it, they put hot coals in it. Vayasimu aleim ketores, and they put incense over that. And they went, and they brought esh zoro l'fnei Hashem. They brought a strange fire before God. Because of that, they were killed. Because of this strange fire. It was improper, whatever they did. So, you would say, why did Nadav and Avihu die? Because they brought a strange fire before God. It says in the Torah, yeah? The rabbis have about 10 different reasons of what Nadav and Avihu did wrong that made them liable to a death penalty. Amongst them are the following. They went in to bring this incense without the proper haircut. A Kohen can't have more than 30 days growth of hair. He has to take a haircut at least every 30 days, and if he has more than a growth of 30 days, he can't go in. It's improper, it's not covered for the Shechina, right, to go in unkempt, and therefore that's what they did. Another opinion was they went in Shtuya Yayin, they were drunk. Not drunk like Purim. They were drunk, they drank a revius of wine, right? One kiddush cup of wine, and didn't sober up after that. They weren't 100% sober. Okay, that's awesome. So you're chayiv misa, you're liable to a death penalty, a kohen, who serves like that. Inebriated with just one revius of wine. Okay. That's what they did. Another opinion is they went in without the proper Big Day Kahuna. They went in with the Big Day Kahuna either torn or missing or whatever. They weren't wearing all the priestly clothing. Another opinion says that they didn't ask advice from Moshe and Aaron, even though what they did was okay. But they should have asked Moshe or asked their father Aaron first, advice, permission. They just did it on their own, without asking advice or permission. Another opinion says they didn't ask advice or permission from each other. Another opinion says that they didn't have children. They didn't get married. And they didn't have children. Right? Because they didn't get married and have children, that's why they were punished. Another opinion says it's because they criticized Moshe and Aaron. They used to stand and watch them walk by and say, when would these old guys die that we could take over? You know, when's a new generation going to take over? Another opinion. And lastly, an opinion says that the reason they were punished really had nothing to do with it right now. There was something that happened before. When the Torah was given, Nadav and Avihu and the 70 Zekanim, right, saw a prophetic vision of God sitting on a throne, right, tremendously high prophetic vision. And they dealt with it, vayochlu vayishtu. They did it as if they were eating and drinking. In other words, they didn't do it with the proper respect. They saw this vision, right, this prophetic vision, and instead of with tremendous respect and awe, they dealt with it frivolously, as if they were eating a meal. That's how they dealt with it, and because of that, the 70 Zekanim were killed in Tavera later on, and Nadav and Avihu were killed now. Why didn't God kill them then, if they sinned then? Because he didn't want to disrupt the simcha of the giving of the Torah. So he waited to a different time. So he got the Sanhedrin, the 70 Zekanim at a different time, and Nadav and Avihu on the day that the Mishkan was dedicated, which opens another question. If God didn't want to disrupt the simcha of the giving of the Torah, why did he disrupt the simcha of dedicating the Mishkan? That was a tremendously happy day. The Gemara says that there was one woman in the world that reached the height of nachas that day. And it was a tremendously happy day. It was the first day of the week. It was a Sunday. It was the first day of the month. It was Rosh Chodesh Nisan. It was the first day that they had Kohanim and a Kohen Gadol and sacrifices. And it was a tremendous, tremendous simcha. This woman, Elisheva Bas Aminadav, Aaron's wife, saw her husband installed as Kohen Gadol and her children as a regular Kohanim. And her brother was Nachshon Ben Aminadav, who brought the first sacrifice. And her brother-in-law was Moshe Rabbeinu, who was leading the whole show. What, do you want a nachas what a woman had that day? And that day, her children died. Two of her children died. Nadav and Avihu. So it says it was a tremendous day of simcha. So God couldn't find a better time to kill these people for something that happened before. He didn't want to kill them then because he didn't want to disrupt the simcha of the giving of the Torah. But now he kills them on this day and disrupts the simcha of the dedication of the Mishkan. That's okay. Why don't you just wait till the next day when there was no big simcha? Kill them then. Why dafka this day? And also, all I just told you doesn't make any sense. The Torah says why they were killed. They brought a strange fire. Why did the rabbis have to find 15 million different reasons why they were killed? It says in the Torah why they were killed. So to answer the question, I think perhaps the answer is the following. The rabbis saw that something missing in this sentence. Because the sentence says that they made a pan, they put in fire, they put on incense, and then they brought a strange fire before God. Why didn't it say they put a strange fire in the pan? It seems to imply that when they put it in, before they brought it in, it was perfectly okay. And the rabbis say that. That even though fire comes down from the heavens onto the altar, there's a mitzvah to bring human fire too. There was a mitzvah to bring those coals and to make that incense. Mitzvah. So then, if it was a mitzvah, then what was wrong with it? The answer is that the way it was done, in the beginning it was totally a mitzvah, but somehow the way that they brought it in turned that mitzvah fire into strange fire. So what was it? What was wrong? That's all these answers. They went in without the right clothing, without the right awe, right, without the right decorum. They were drunk, they were, no, without hair, whatever it was. That's what transformed the fire of mitzvah into the fire that was a strange fire for which they were liable to a death penalty. So that answers why the rabbis had to find other reasons if the Torah says Eish Zara. The answer is the Eish Zara wasn't because there was something wrong intrinsically with the fire. It's because the way the fire was brought in was a problem. Okay, so we've answered that. But we haven't answered the other question. If they already were liable for a sin they did when the Torah was given, right, and God didn't want to disrupt the simcha of the giving of the Torah, then why did he disrupt the simcha of this day? So I think the answer is the following. If you look at the thread, that a common thread in all the sins that are mentioned, it basically is the following idea. And that is a tremendous Yetzer Hara, but it seems to be a frum Yetzer Hara, which exists in the world and exists by many people, some to a greater degree, some to a lesser degree, and it even exists by leaders who mislead people and seemingly do it in a way that people don't understand they're being misled. And it becomes very popular. Now that I got your interest, let me tell you what I'm talking about. The Netziv says, in the beginning of the Sedra, it says, Ze hadover asher tzivu Hashem tasu, v'yero aleichem kvod Hashem. Take this Yetzer Hara out of your heart, and then you'll be able to have a Mishkan, and God's presence will be here. What was this Yetzer Hara that they had? The Mishkan was an atonement for the sin of the golden calf. According to many opinions, the golden calf itself intrinsically was nothing terrible. It was something they wanted to use. They wanted to create an intermediary between them and God. They needed something to represent God to them. And even though it seems strange, a golden calf, but is it any more strange than an Aron Kodesh? Right? We bow towards the Aron Kodesh. Does anybody really think that God is inside the Aron Kodesh? That God lives in a closet? Right? So why do we bow towards the Aron Kodesh? Because we need something to direct our attention to. We can't, you know, stand on one foot and revolve around, up, down, all around, you know, what's it called? God's everywhere. We're human beings. We need to focus on something. So God told us, okay, fine, I want you to build a Mishkan. There's an Aron in the Mishkan. There's a menorah. Those are symbols of me and my midos, my character, characteristics or whatever, and you can relate to me through them. So then what's wrong with taking an eagle? I think we explained in Precious Kisisa why the eagle. They were in the desert. They needed the power of food and the power of what's it called, of God's strength to protect them from the dangers of the desert. In God's throne, there's a shore, an ox. The ox is a symbol of food. The ox that plows or whatever, that prepares food. And the ox is also a symbol of strength. So they needed that symbol in God's throne to be the intermediary between them and God. So that's what they did. So what's so terrible? What's the difference between a golden calf or a golden ark? The answer is very simple. The golden ark said, God said to do it. The golden calf, they decided to do it. And that's what the Kuzri says. The only difference is God the one who's telling you how to get close to him, or are you deciding how to get close to him? If it's your decision, then it's avodah zarah. Then it's strange worship. If it's God's decision, that's worship of God. God will tell you how he wants you to serve him. And in fact, one of the sins that the rabbis say is that they did what the tzedukim do. On Yom Kippur, the halacha is that the Kohen Gadol goes into the Holy of Holies with incense. But he does not put the incense on the fire until he gets into the Holy of Holies. That's the halacha. The halacha is that when he goes in, he takes the coals separately and the incense separately. And there, in the Holy of Holies, he puts the incense on the coals. The tzedukim didn't believe that. They said, you don't do that to an earthly king. You don't bring his meal to him and prepare it in front of him, unless you're in a Japanese restaurant. But otherwise, normally, normal people prepare the food in the kitchen, and they serve it ready-made, right, to the king on his plate. You don't go to a restaurant and they prepare your food in front of you on the table. Again, Japanese restaurants are different, but we see what happens to the Japanese. Right, in normal places, right, if they come and prepare your food in front of you on the table, you think they're out of your mind. Prepare the food, bring it to me, ready-made or whatever. That's nice. So the Tsnukim said, you don't do this to an earthly king. You don't bring his meal in front of him as if, and prepare it in front of him. You prepare it before and bring it in prepared. So they held that you put the incense on the coals outside and then brought it in already smoking, brought it into the Holy of Holies. Says Rav Shamshon Fol Hirsch, that is the difference between the tzeduki and what the Torah really wants. The Torah wants you to bring your raw materials to God and he'll tell you what he wants. Don't foist on him what you think is proper. Don't say, you know what, I don't think it's proper for me to bring this in and do it in front of God. I think it's more proper, and then you'll decide what's proper and do the way you think. That's Avodah Zarah. Let God tell you what he wants. Do it the way he wants, not the way you think he should want. Once you decide for God how you think he should want it, that's Avodah Zarah. Let God decide how he wants it done. So that was the underlying sin. The underlying sin was they wanted to get close to God. Here's a day when the fire from the heavens is going to come down. God's presence is there with them. And these two tzaddikim, they were big tzaddikim, they wanted to have a closeness to God. They wanted to get close to God. But they wanted to do it their way. They didn't ask advice, not from their father, not from their Rebbe, Moshe Rabbeinu. They didn't ask advice from each other. They went in a little drunk, meaning they didn't go with this proper awe and decorum and dikduk, mitzvahs need to be done properly. They didn't care about properly. They just abandon themselves to the ecstasy of getting close to God. It didn't make a difference if you did it properly or improperly. Just do it. And that is the Yetzer Hara. It's a fruma Yetzer Hara. A lot of people who want to get close to God, but their understanding of getting close to God is how I feel close. So some people, have Friday night services, right, where somebody comes with a guitar. Right, and they really play Zvekistika music or whatever, and everybody's really, into it. In addition, maybe some people are smoking whatever, to get really into a mood, or drinking, right? They're a similar thing. They're intoxicated. They don't basically care if they're dressed properly, not dressed properly, have the right haircut, don't have the right haircut. All of that is details. But you want to get close to God, just throw yourself to the abandon of the moment and the feeling and the emotion. The main thing is the emotion. But it's not true. In order for the emotion is very important, but it has to be contained within a framework. And the framework is called Dikduk HaMitzvah. It means that there is a regimen. There is details, and you have to keep those details, and you have to do it in a way that's respectful and the way that God wants it, not the way you want it, right? Not how you think you can get close to God, but how God wants you to get close to him. And if he tells you, look, these are the details, this is what you have to do. So to do the mitzvahs without any emotion is also no good. That's like a robot, that's cold. But first you have to know that you have the right framework, and then you fill it with emotion. But you don't create the framework from the emotion. The emotion doesn't create the framework. The emotion fills the framework. That's Torah and Mitzvahs. Torah and Mitzvahs is, first you have the dikduk, the idea of what's proper, what's improper, how much not, what are the parameters, what's the framework, and then you fill it with emotion. But you can't just do it with emotion. That was the Yetzer Hara they had. Do it your way. Right, that's how you hear everybody tell you. Do it your way. Everybody has their way of serving God. That's absurd. God has his way. And you have to... And his way has many areas for individuality. But you have to fit somehow into the framework. You can't just make up your own framework. And that was the sin of Nadav and Avihu. They did it because they wanted to get closer to God. There is tremendous ecstasy. The karvasim of Hashem, they want to get close. But you have to get close in the way that God wants it, with all of the details, with all of the hakpadas, with all of the making sure that you do it properly. There's a proper way, there's an improper way. You can't just do whatever you want. And there are many people that, religious people, they want religion, but they want it their way. And therefore they have all these crazy things that have no connection, no source in anything. But this is the way that we are going to relate to God, for instance. An example. And this is with frum people, people who consider themselves shomer mitzvahs, many of them. Like, God didn't get it right, because boys are born, and they have a bris on the eighth day. So you have, you know, this simcha, and it's a way to enhance the birth and to connect it to God. What about girls? What do girls have? Right? A kiddush, big deal. Right? So they decided that since God got it wrong, and he didn't have a ceremony that he made for girls, so they're going to make a ceremony for girls. On the eighth day, they have a brita, right, which is not one of these water filters. It's much, much collected. It is connected to it, right? It is connected. What's the brita? What's the mitzvah of a woman? A mikvah. Okay? So they are going to induce or introduce this little eight-day-old girl to the mitzvah of mikvah. Okay? So they have a basin of water, whatever. It's very similar to something from a different religion, right? Called baptism. But that's exactly what they do, because baptism is a mikvah. John the Baptist was a person who was tovo people in mikvahs, right? That was what he was. That's what baptism is, a mikvah. Except they don't go for the whole big mikvah. They just sprinkle a little water on. That's right. Too difficult. So they take this little girl. They don't tovo her in a mikvah, but they. I don't know whether they have some kind of basin of water. They say psukim about how important it is, what's it called, purity or whatever. And they made a whole ceremony. What's wrong with it? Is there anything wrong with saying psukim? Or what's wrong with it is, God didn't say to do that. Right? You can't just make up your own religion. It's a new religion. This is not the way the Rabban Shalom said it. And what are you saying? God got it wrong. Right? Because God didn't think of this. Right? He discriminated against women. Because God doesn't like women for some reason. Right, so therefore, that's why he gave him Pesach. Right, so they for some reason God doesn't like women, so he just, you know, not important if girls are born, right? So we have to correct God's mistakes. So we have to make something that will make it right, because this is the way we feel we can get. That's a Avodah Zarah. Yeah.
What's the difference between that and Purim and Hanukkah and everything else we've added to the Torah?
Excellent question. The Rambam answers. Ram says the following. In those guidelines, there are guidelines also for additions. When it's proper to add and for what purpose. Okay? That's part of the system. The system says like this. We learn. How does the Gemara know that you can make a holiday Purim? The Gemara learns it from the fact that what? That if from slavery to freedom, the Torah made a yontif, then from death to life, surely there's a yontif. And they learned it from Sukkim. So in the system of the Torah itself said that if there will be this kinds of situations, then it is the will of God that you institute days, rabbinic days, right? Not Torah days, rabbinic days, that celebrate these kinds of things. Right? And there's specific guidelines of when the system says to do these things. The system gives the rabbis the power to make fences around the Torah. But it limits that power. For instance, it gives the power for them to make a fence around the Torah, but not a fence around the fence. It gives them the power to make a fence around the Torah of something that most people could do. But if they see that most people can't do it originally, then they have no power to make such a thing. There are other rules also. So the rabbis, the Torah gave the rabbis certain powers that's part of the system. To make additions, not additions to the Torah, because the rabbis have to tell you this is only rabbinic. But where do we get that power from? The Torah. And if they won't have the power from the Torah, they can't do it. Then you're right. Then it's adding to the Torah. So it has to fit some kind of guideline. And there are guidelines. So the rabbis follow those guidelines. But if people just do whatever they want, right, because they feel, right, so we just have the feeling for it, then it doesn't fit into those guidelines at all. Therefore, Torah, God said like this. The day the Torah was given, okay, was a day of tremendous God showing his tremendous love for the Jewish people. He gave us a Torah. He didn't want to destroy that simcha of killing other Navi. There would be no purpose to it. But the day that Avoda, service to God, was dedicated. If I let this go, then people are going to think that that's the way to serve God. However you want. Just let your emotions carry you away. And therefore God said this is the day to kill him. Because this is the day that Avoda, that service, is being, what's it called, dedicated. The lesson that people will learn, that look what Nadav and Avihu, they had tremendous emotion and they wanted to get close to me, but they didn't do it the proper way and it led to their death. Right? It's like, you know what it's like? It's not that they were punished. God killed them. You know what it's like? All of you can relate to this because we all come from Chutz Laretz, except I'm not sure of the English, but the Americans for sure. In America, the voltage was 110. If you bring a appliance that's 110 and plug it into 220, you know what happens to it? It burns out. Right? That's it. Finished. You're not punishing the appliance. It just can't take the current. Too much. Right? There are certain limitations to the motors of things that are made for 110 current. They can't take 220 current. So you need either a transformer, or you got to get a different appliance that has a motor that fits this thing. People want that 220 voltage, but they're not wired for it. It's not, that's not the misgeret. That's not the what's it called, the framework. So if you plug yourself in to 220 and you're not geared for it, right, and it's not the right misgeret. Mine must have stopped 15 minutes ago. No. In any case, it doesn't make a difference. I think the battery went out about an hour ago. Okay, whatever. You'll have to get yours. In any case, so that's what happened to them. They had this tremendous essence. They wanted to plug themselves into God, but they didn't realize that the way to plug in, there are rules. And if you plug into something that's beyond your framework, you burn yourself out. That's what happened to them. They got burnt out. They plugged into a 220 current when they're only 110. And you can't just plug yourself in any way you want. There's ways of doing it properly. You need that transformer. You need the rules in order to be able to make that connection properly. And if you decide to make the connection in an improper way, then it's not that they were punished. They were killed because God killed. They just burnt out. It was beyond their capabilities of receiving that closeness to God in a way that it's like a short circuit. Right? If you don't, God knows how to make the wiring. If you start making your own wiring because, oh, well, I like the blue wire, looks nice next to the red one, and the yellow one looks nice, but you have no idea what's all about, right? You just decide emotionally that this is the way the wire should be. Don't try that in your house. You need an electrician who knows what the wires are, even if emotionally and aesthetically they may not look, oh, the black one with the yellow one or whatever, right? How come the red one and the green one seem to be nicer together? Right, but you have to know what's going on. And if you just approach it emotionally, aesthetically, but not with what the proper framework is, then you could cause tremendous short circuits, fires, who knows what other kind of damage. So you have to let the electrician tell you how to make the connection, and then you can turn the switch and it'll work. But if you don't let the electrician make the connections, you make it according to your emotional and aesthetic desires, then you can cause terrible damage, right, with that same current that could be life-giving and light-giving and very, very positive. The same current can be destructive, electrocute somebody, cause fires, short circuits, who knows what. That's...